Right? He abandons, you know, belief and faith, iman, because he doesn't believe it to be very important, right? Doesn't necessarily mean that he is, you know, passionate to abandon it, right? Abandoning it is, it's not something that one could, you know, be passionate about, right? So it's not an action itself, or it's just actually an inaction, right? But because one does not deem this action of faith or believing to be significant, something very important, oh, he doesn't believe in it, right? Similarly, the one who abandons the prayer, he abandons it because he doesn't think it's very important. He doesn't believe it to be very important. The inaction itself, it doesn't like draw him towards it, right? So because of that, it, you know, this person who abandons the prayer, he's been compared to the kafir, to the infidel, and not the one who fornicates. You know, it's interesting to know that in the Holy Quran, regarding the people who have gone to hell, it's the following has been mentioned. These people will be asked, "What drew you into hell?" They will answer, we were not amongst those who prayed." One of the reasons why people will go to hell is that they were people who abandoned prayers. They left the prayers. They abandoned it. And you know, this actual act of taking prayers lightly, it's something very bad. Imam Baqir alayhi salam said, "Do not neglect your prayers. For verily the Prophet said, while he was on his deathbed, 'The one who takes his prayers lightly is not from me.'" Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at the abandonment of prayers in the words of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
This one lay. Doing a sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The UK Chancellor has unveiled a new budget to tackle soaring inflation and the cost of living crisis. But will his plan work? It's supposed to fill a £54 billion black hole in the UK government budget. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at that budget, which is called austerity by many circumstances, see if it is feasible or just projection-based, and also whether the Chancellor's much-dreaded austerity program will help UK's economy, which is projected to face the worst recession on record. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Former member of the British Parliament, Lembit Opik, joins us from London. Also joining us is journalist, author, and activist Fra Hughes, who joins us from Belfast.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
All right, welcome, gentlemen. Let me first start with you, Lempit Opik, if I may. We are taking a look at a budget that right off the bat has been called an austerity budget. And taking a look at the definition of what austerity is, it fits all of it. Policies that are considered an increase in taxes, cutting back on government programs, like health care services, aid to veterans, maybe a reduction in pensions, reduction in salaries, although the reduction in pensions is not mentioned. Why is it called an austerity package, you think?
Because it's a familiar phrase, but what you could call it is a disaster package. When it comes down to it, when you have an overheating economy, you increase taxes and you increase inflation rates, you increase things to reduce inflation, but you also increase things like interest rates. If you have a weak economy, then you reduce those things. This budget is neither. We've got a situation now where we've got a £2 trillion economy with roughly a £2 trillion deficit. But the fundamental problem here is, as far as I can see, that Rishi Sunak has to put right what successive governments have done wrong for many years. What does this mean in practical terms, in not economic terms? The poor will pay much more in their taxes. The rich will as well, but they can afford it. So we live in a situation now where the United Kingdom, the sixth biggest economy in the world, is punishing the poor for the mistakes of politicians. And that's something I would never have voted for when I was an MP.
So are we looking at the party itself to have failed successive economic policies, perhaps, Fra Hughes? I mean, this one in particular, couldn't say it better based on a headline that said just about everyone is going to pay more taxes. Tax rises for all. Looking at £55 billion belt tightening measures due to these tax rises. Is that an accurate description?
I think it is, yes, 100%. I think for a lot of people to hear the word, you know, everyone knows what tax raises actually mean, more money taken out from the public, from people's disposable income after they've paid for everything else, their mortgage, their housing rent, their food, their fuel. And austerity is just a word that people like vaguely know stuff about. So in order to kind of see if this is an austerity budget and where it's going to take us in the future, I just took the liberty of writing down a few notes from a book that was written on Tory austerity. It's called The Lost Decade, and it covers the years 2010 to 2020. Now, apparently there are more food banks in Britain than there are McDonald's. 600,000 children have fallen back into relative poverty. Life expectancy has shortened. One in five girls and young women are cutting, burning, or poisoning themselves. Infant mortality rates have risen for the first time in two generations. The public realm is employing a smaller proportion of the workforce than it has done since 1945. 25% of all local government jobs no longer exist. Two-thirds of children in poverty have at least one parent working. Theresa May said in 2018 austerity had ended, yet in real terms, job salaries for many have remained stagnant for over a decade. Nurses, firemen, postal workers and rail workers are either on strike or about to go on strike. And while many European governments have renationalized the energy companies, what Britain declared yesterday was that they were going to spend £5.8 billion building more ships. So what we have is a further removal of wealth from the poor to the rich through this agenda. And it proves that Rishi Sunak, the present British Prime Minister, when he was Chancellor of the Exchequer, his assets and those of his wife and his family were supposed to be more than £700 million, which was more than the £600 million that the Queen was supposed to have had as her kind of disposable income or money, right, that she could reach as an asset. So Rishi Sunak's wife hasn't paid any tax. These people are so removed from the public domain that they have absolutely nothing in common with the poor of Britain.
Yeah, I don't think I heard what you said after all the statistics, because I was really just drowning in that. No, I did hear you, but I was so drowned into the severity and the shock factor of some of the points that you made there, which I'm tempted to ask you this question, Lempidopic, that the Conservatives should not even be up for voting. They should be eliminated if that's the type of output is coming out of the UK economy. Are we looking at failed economic policies from the Conservative Party, or is it more to the story, as if there was somebody else that was heading the ship, they would still fall flat like they did?
You asked me three questions. First of all, the Conservatives have completely messed up with the economy, which is the one thing that people used to vote for when they voted Conservative. Secondly, yes, successive governments have done that. This is the irony. The Labour Party and the Conservatives both made similar mistakes, leading to this meltdown. Remember that the 2008 meltdown was really under the leadership of the Labour Party. They didn't cause the global recession, but they did not protect against it. Thirdly, the biggest question that you ask, can anyone do better? Not at the moment, because Keir Starmer has no better solution than Rishi Sunak. At least, whether you like him or you don't like him, Jeremy Hunt is talking about these terribly difficult decisions. I would actually take a different economic philosophy. I studied economics at university. I was top of my class at school on this, so maybe I've got some qualification to talk about this. But Keir Starmer is not in any way credible. His position about creating a net zero national grid for electricity by 2030 is just ludicrous. He doesn't explain how he does anything. He doesn't really tell the rich or the poor what he's going to do about tax. So wherever you stand on the climate, wherever you stand on tax, nobody knows what Keir Starmer will do. And I suspect if he had a good story to tell, he'd tell it.
I think they don't have a clear-cut plan, do they? Lempidopic,
no.
In terms of what to do at this point. Let me ask you, who's the spokesperson. Rachel Reeves said the government has forced our economy into a doom loop where low growth leads to higher taxes, lower investment, and squeezed wages, with the running down of public services, all of which hits economic growth again. So that's what she has said. Your reaction to that, if you agree, and of course the fact that, as I asked Lempidopic, they don't have a clear-cut economic plan to present instead of what's being presented out there by Jeremy Hunt.
Well, I do agree with what Rachel has said. Maybe what I would add to it is, you know, it may be a vicious circle, but it could be broken at any time, because I am a strong believer in the redistribution of wealth, and that is the part of the problem here, that there is no fair distribution of wealth within the United Kingdom. I believe if tax avoidance was ended, that the national debt could be wiped out practically overnight. One-third of the billionaires in Britain have their money in tax havens and pay absolutely no tax. Many corporations do exactly the same. They avoid paying their tax, which is actually stealing public services from the people who are most in need. I don't believe that successive British governments have failed politically, or their policies have not brought about the economic boom that they claim to want for the people on the island of Britain. I believe that successively, from Margaret Thatcher on, they moved to privatise all the public utilities. They moved on to create wealth for companies at the expense of their workers. And then what we had after the crash and after 2010 was there was nothing else to privatise, there was nothing else to give away. So then they brought in austerity, which I believe the Tory government, every time it gets into power, wants to reduce public spending. It wants to send the people back into the Victorian age of the workhouse. And that's why we have food banks, that's why we have more children in poverty than ever before, and that's why mental health, homelessness, drug abuse, violence on the streets, and crime are all skyrocketing, because the government has taken away the safety net and the mental health security for the nation and have basically abandoned the people in order to finance the rich and to continue with the war effort with these new ships at the £5.8 billion that they're about to spend, which could be spent on the health service, could be spent in welfare payments, and could be spent creating housing and employment for the people of Britain.
When you talk about the redistribution of wealth, that's a very interesting point. It sounds easy enough for that to be redistributed in a sense. Technically, I'm not too sure. I don't have the knowledge of that. But aren't we looking at a deeper problem that the UK is suffering from? And that is that it's not the manufacturing type country that it used to be. And a lot of the services, especially in London, are focused on the financial services, for example. Is that one of the things that is ailing the UK as a whole?
Well, I would say the fact that Britain can no longer compete in the world when it comes to manufacturing, when you have China, India, Pakistan, and other subcontinent countries that can perform and outbid, outbuild, and in many cases, outprofit Britain. Under Margaret Thatcher, the coal industry was killed off, the steel industry was killed off, the trade union movement was decimated. And yes, Britain now is more a service country. The money does come in and out of the City of London, the financial sector. But that's all speculation. That's all shares. That's all people betting on where the economy is going to go, where interest rates are going to go. So there is no manufacturing base, and places like the north of England have been totally devastated. But that doesn't mean, I mean, Lambert said it's the sixth richest economy in the world. You can't tell me that there are multi-billionaires and yet you can't have money for an adequate health service or teach children in schools or give them school dinners, because austerity is a political choice. It is not an economic necessity. Therefore, all these policies are choices by the government. They are the wrong choices for the poor and they are the right charges for the rich. And that's why we see inequality grow day by day and hour by hour in one of the largest economies in the world.
One of the things that's very worrisome, given the economic climate, not just for the UK, Frau Hughes, I'm sure you're aware of other European countries that are suffering in their economies in one way or another. But when you take a look at the poor, they're the ones that are obviously going to suffer more. Now, Jeremy Hunt has promised, based on what he has unveiled, that public services is not going to be affected as much. He has provided funds for it. But when push comes to shove and the money has to be spent, there's got to be projections and tax cuts that are involved in that speculation, which then many are hoping to translate into reality. Do you think that public services are going to take a hit and not reap any benefits that is being promised at this point?
Well, every government claims that it puts more money into the health service than the previous government. But say you put in $1 billion, just to pick a random figure. If you say, well, we put in $1.1 billion into the health service, which is more than the previous government, when you take in the rise in the cost of services, of drugs, of pharmaceuticals, of prosthesis that are used in surgery, and the rise in cost in patient transport, wages for nurses and doctors when eventually they get pay raises. In real terms, this means all those public services are being decimated again day by day and hour by hour. They're falling by the wayside. And I wouldn't believe a word James Hunt said. I wouldn't believe a word Rishi Sunak said. I am old enough to have realized that these people are just soundbites who say something for 30 seconds or 60 seconds on the television in order to appease the public. They are giving, I think it's every home in Great Britain and Northern Ireland, £400 to defer against the energy costs. But instead of capping the energy rate, they are allowing that to continue, although they will reduce it until April next year. What they are doing is subsidizing yet again private profit from energy companies with public money, and they are giving people money to appease the public so that there are not major riots on the streets of Britain, which is a distinct possibility when you see what's happening in the rest of Europe. But as I say, without nationalizing the energy companies, it will be very difficult to help the people who are most affected by this downturn in the economy, rising rates, and the fact that the people who can least afford this are going to be hardest hit. And again, I don't think that the government cares much for those people, because quite a few of them don't vote for the Conservative Party and none of them are donors.
Okay. Lumpet Opik is back with us. Lumpet Opik, I'm still trying to get over the Frau Hughes stat on how there are more food banks than McDonald's. But this particular example, I think, is something that needs to be highlighted, where it's a new source, it claims, to be of economic anxiety in the UK, and that is mortgages, and how after more than a decade of, I guess, low interest rates, people in the UK are suffering from, new homeowners especially, are suffering from the interest rate hikes, where one particular example, this particular person said she bought her first home, a one-bedroom in Croydon in South London, and then a year and a half later, she is bracing for a nearly 80% jump in her monthly mortgage payments. I mean, is that what we're looking at? And how can people then afford their mortgages?
Yes, all the above. I'm sorry, I've got some very bad regional problems tonight. Maybe this is an indication of the state of the United Kingdom. But the serious point you're making here is right. People's cost of living isn't going up by 80%. It can be going up by 200%. Many people have fixed rate mortgages at 1.7%. You don't have to understand the mathematics here, but if I say that they've gone up 6%, you can understand that it's gone up three times since they got their mortgage. So if they were paying £500 a month in the past, they'll be paying £1,500 a month. Then you add the fact that they're going to be paying maybe £2,000 a year extra in terms of their energy costs, and the food has gone up by a couple of £1,000. Britain is bankrupt. We're insolvent. And this is the sixth biggest country in the world. It used to claim to be the second fastest growing or the fastest growing. Everything that my colleague there has said is right. At the end of the day, we're in a situation where we are in crisis Britain, not promising Britain. And Rishi Sunak has approved an increase in taxes, which will hurt the poor the most. Where do we go from here? Well, there's nothing wrong with the situation that a miracle wouldn't fix. But that's what it will take to get Britain out of its current mess.
Okay, thank you for that. Lempit Opik, we do appreciate it. Former member of the British Parliament there talking to us from London. And I'm going to come to you now, Frahiz, with what the Bank of England has warned that the UK is facing its longest recession on record, and economic downturn is expected to extend well into 2024. Now, the rising interest rates is one of the reasons that is a double-edged sword, because you have to tame inflation. But at the same time, when you have the interest rates rise, you can't give out, I mean, you can give out loans, but the higher rate dissuades, is not that attractive for people to take out, whether it's for businesses, homes, et cetera. Are we looking at a downturn that's predicted that this new budget can then face with this type of stat coming out from the Bank of England based on what they've presented?
Well, I don't think the budget that's being put forward is in any way going to have an effect, in my mind, for the interest rates going forward. A lot of this is this recession that's going to go into 2024. We've all been here before. It's a capitalist boom and bust system. Even the Bible said there were 7 years of lean and 7 years of fat. If you take the financial crisis of 2008, which was brought about by the deregulation of the banks, that's why that came about. There was no kind of fiscal pressure put on the banks, and they just kind of ran away with people's money and ran away with their own ideas of how to create more profit. You're right, it's a catch-22. Whenever interest rates go up, then the cost of borrowing becomes more expensive. Therefore, businesses that are in trouble won't be able to get access to more finance. People who are considering opening a business or starting a business won't have access to the finance because they won't be able in the short term to pay back the high repayments. Then you have mortgages that may default, and people could possibly become homeless and their houses seized and people put out onto the streets. But for my mind, and I'm not an economist, but I believe a lot of this is just pure profiteering from the companies. The profiteering from the energy sector, the profiteering from the food sector, the profiteering from everything and everywhere and everyone. They're just all these companies and corporations using the excuse of inflation and the war in Ukraine to just stick their arm into the public purse and stick their arms into the pockets of the members of the public in order to make obscene profits. So if they stopped, if they found a way to stop this obscene profiteering, then there wouldn't be a need to increase interest rates. The reason why so much money is being spent in society right now is because everything has gone up in price, and a lot of people will be spending their savings just to stand still. So by increasing interest rates in order to slow down the amount of money that's being spent in the economy, correct way to do that is to stop the profiteering.
Yeah, I wish we had come up with this point earlier, because what you're saying then is they're taking advantage of the situation for whatever they can come up with, whether it's broken supply chains or what have you. Too bad we just don't have the time, but thank you very much for that, Fra Hughes, journalist, author, and activist. And we had Lembit Opik with us prior, former member of the British Parliament from London. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tathway, it's goodbye.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, I'm Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll try to discuss the commentary of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Wa'uzlifatil jannatu lil muttaqin.
And paradise will be brought near that day to the righteous. And hellfire will be brought forth for the deviators. And it will be said to them, "Where are those you used to worship?"
وأزلفت الجنة للمتقين.
And paradise will be brought near that day to the righteous.
Brothers and sisters, as you were previously with us, we were discussing the 90th verse of this chapter, where the Holy Quran says, وأزلفت الجنة للمتقين. The paradise shall be brought near for the pious. وبرزت الجحيم للغاوين. And the hell shall appear plainly to the erring ones. And the 92nd verse, وَقِيلَ لَهُمْ أَيْنَمَا كُنْتُمْ تَعْبُدُونَ. And it will be said to them, "Where are those that you used to worship?" Now, as you were with us in the previous episode, we mentioned that the glad tidings of the Lord precedes the warnings of Him. So at first He says, "Uzlifatil Jannah." paradise will be brought for the pious ones, and then it is time for the unbelievers. Burrizat al-Jahim lil-Ghawin. Now, seeing what you have prepared for yourself with your own deed in the world, is the first level, is the first step of your chastisement or your rewards. If you see a great paradise beneath which the rivers flow, this is your reward. The seeing, merely having that sight in front of you. And of course, on the other hand, if you are from among the unbelievers, being deviated in the world, you will see hell plainly in your sight. So the point is that your belief, your ideology, plays an important role in whatever your destiny will be. Why? Because the Holy Quran pays to the scorning statement that at this time it will be said to this deviated group, and it says, it shall be said to them, where are those that you used to worship? أَيْنَمَا كُنْتُمْ تَعْبُدُونَ. This means they used to believe in some other gods other than Allah. They used to worship the other things, like the idols. This is what they believed in that world. And that is why they are now in this situation. على مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا. We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
So the Holy Quran mentions this scorning statement, وَقِيلَ لَهُمْ أَيْنَمَا كُنْتُمْ تَعْبُدُونَ. It will be said to them, where are those that you used to worship? And it's not just this group that will be questioned for their beliefs in the world. Every group, each and every one of us, will be asked questions of our thoughts, of our beliefs. قِيلَ لَهُمْ أَيْنَمَا كُنْتُمْ تَعْبُدُونَ. This is not just for the unbelievers. This is not just for these deviators, based on the other verses of the Holy Quran. And if you used to worship these idols, if you were from among the unbelievers in the world, apart from seeing this sight of hell, which is plainly visible in front of you, this is one aspect of your chastisement, you will be scorned on that day. This is yet another kind of spiritual chastisement for the unbelievers. Now, what we understand from this verse of the Holy Quran is that all the human beings are inclined to worshipping. It is inherently put among all the human beings to worship something. But some try to deviate this inclination from its original and true destination. And in that time, not just the unbelievers, but also the ones that they worshipped will be put into hellfire. وَقِيلَ لَهُمْ أَيْنَمَا كُنْتُمْ تَعْبُدُونَ. It will be said to them, where are those that you used to worship? And this is what the next verses explicitly mention. فَكُبْكِبُوا فِيهَا هُمْ وَالْغَابُونَ. That we will, God willing, try to mention in the next episodes. Thank you for staying with us, dear listeners. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with the reporters.
Transfixed, ordinary Britons stand glued to their screens, waiting for the news to sink in. After weeks of will he not, the UK's new Chancellor has announced his economic plan for the country. Except for a couple of surprise rabbits out of the hat, such as a bit of more spending in the health and education sectors, it was what everyone had expected. Tax hikes and spending cuts aimed at plugging a nearly $65 billion hole in public finances created by the previous Conservative government only 2 months ago. Pretty soon, millions of Britons will be paying more taxes. A freeze on the non-taxable part of their income will mean millions will be dragged into higher tax brackets, and the cap on energy bills introduced by the previous government will be scaled back as of April next year. As if that wasn't enough, Britons are going to see public sector spending cuts to the tune of $30 billion. All this as the country grapples with double-digit inflation, rising energy costs, and a prolonged recession, none of which was lost on the opposition.
What does this mean? Family holidays cancelled.
Yeah, yeah.
Savings depleted.
Yeah.
Hopes for the future replaced by sleepless nights.
Yeah.
And all of this on top of the fact that the average worker is earning less today than when the Tories came to power 12 years ago. The government has presided over the biggest wage squeeze in centuries.
Yeah.
This was a crisis made in Downing Street, and it is ordinary working people who are paying the price.
As ever, the Chancellor, as did the PM before him, blamed Britain's economic woes on the pandemic and external factors such as the war in Ukraine. But many experts say that's not all.
There are international factors. However, Britain has managed to achieve something on its own for one or two areas, such as the impact of Brexit. Whereas when they were in the EU, they had access to the world's largest free trade area. Britain deliberately took itself out of that and hasn't been able to replace it with anything. So that's had extra costs to it. And so there's also been less confidence in Britain because it's outside that. Why should I be investing? And so if it's not seen to be as really secure and full of confidence, then investors will go elsewhere. And that's what we've been seeing.
Despite the government saying its measures announced today are necessary for balancing the books, there is no doubt that they will have real consequences for millions of Britons for years to come. Saipur is up, London.
The Taliban's Ministry of Vice and Virtue have banned Afghan women from visiting all parks, using gyms and public baths.
Recently, women are banned from going to parks, sports clubs, and public baths by the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. For the past 15 months, the orders given to these places were violated and ignored. That's why now it is decided that they should be banned. It is not clear how long the restrictions would last or whether they are going to be lifted.
The famous city park in Kabul, once filled with families' joy and laughter, now has turned idle and silent, with only a handful of men wandering through the complex. The ban order has also affected the livelihoods of people who have been making ends meet by working at public places.
They are interrupting our livelihoods with their decisions. Now they have banned women, so less customers are visiting here. Look, it's in the middle of the day, but no visitors. I have rented a photography shop here, and I used to have an adequate income. But now the ban is making me close it down.
Women's rights activists urge the Taliban to reverse its course on all women's rights, saying such decisions would provoke national outrage.
Instead of attempting to ban the doors of parks for women, the Taliban should manage to let Afghan boys and girls learn. They should address the economic and humanitarian crisis in the country rather than focusing on weird restrictions on women. I'm sure such decisions expose the reality of the Taliban and would face public anger.
The Taliban have already banned women from traveling without a male relative. Secondary schools for girls have also been shut for over a year across the country. Afghan women are worried about being barred from public places after the authorities announced the new restrictions. The women are now calling for justice, demanding the authorities protect their rights. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
In Shah-e-Dharab, a week-long exhibition in Indian-administered Kashmir is displaying dozens of rare manuscripts written by prominent poet Khwaja Muhammad Amin Dharab. The language was once officially used in courts and commerce until 1889. The organizers say the aim of the event is to revive Persian language in the region. About 73 manuscripts, including a dozen books written by Dharab, are on display.
Persian is so
deeply entrenched that you can't think of our craft without Persian. You can't think of Kashmiri language, forget about Persian, without Persian language. You can't think of our basic ethical and sacred knowledge without Persian.
Persian is what Kashmir is all about. And it still has a resonance in contemporary Kashmiri society. If you go to any urs on any major shrine of Kashmir, the manqabat and the naats that are recited will be jami, they will be in Persian.
Chronogram on Neil Armstrong's landing on the moon, Maharaja of Kashmir's accession to the throne in 1923, elegies of prominent scholars, including on the death of Muslim scholar and jurist Maulana Anwar Shah Kashmiri, are being displayed in the exhibition. The Arab was instrumental in transmitting traditional Persian literature in the region. He is also known as a master of Kitah Tariq and Naats in the praise of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. The Arab died in 1979 in Srinagar, but his memories and writings continue to enlighten hearts and minds in the region. The remnants of Persian verses are widely recited in mosques, shrines, Sufi and spiritual gatherings. The Persian language reached its peak in Kashmir during the Mughal rule, but faded with the course of time. The exhibition organizers say events like this are an ideal platform to revive Persian language and literature.
I want people to know what he has written, because if you keep it in boxes, nobody would know. Maybe the language is not here anymore, but the language never dies. See, even now some people are so interested in it, that's why we are getting a good response. And there is so much of culture in this language, there is so much of history about Kashmir as well in the language, because it's somehow connected with Iran.
Organizers say the Rab's contribution to Persian literature in the valley is also highlighted in documentation of the greatest poets, Ghani Kashmiri. Munawar Zaman, Indian administered Kashmir.
A resolution was recently presented to the UN General Assembly for the first time after the Taliban took over Afghanistan. While discussing issues including security, terrorism, and the social and economic situation, the Assembly significantly refrained to recognize the Taliban as a government. Experts believe this could affect the nation.
Non-recognition of the Taliban by the global community could negatively affect Afghanistan. It would bring illegitimacy to the Taliban government. It would also have consequences for the country's diplomatic relations, trade, and culture. There may even be more sanctions. These could have adverse effects on people, especially the poor.
In response to this resolution, Suhail Shaheen, the head of the political office of the Islamic Emirate in Qatar, said according to Islamic principles and values, the Taliban are committed to fulfilling all the legitimate rights and demands of the people, and that they are trying to provide the right means and environment to achieve this goal. Experts say the recognition of the Taliban could have positive results.
If the Taliban government is recognized after the observation of human rights and some other standards by the Taliban, it could have very good results for the nation, such as in the fields of international relations and international economic interactions.
Since the Taliban took control 15 months ago, their non-recognition, along with the sanctions imposed on the central bank and the freezing of Afghan assets, has driven the economy of the country to the brink of collapse. It is believed the recognition of Taliban may be a way to improve the situation in the country. But on the other hand, releasing assets and removing sanctions could also be effective. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
On Monday, the European Union announced new sanctions on a number of Iranian officials and three organizations, including Iran's 24-hour English news channel Press TV, for alleged crackdown on protests which began following the death of Mahsa Amini, a young Iranian woman who collapsed in police custody and was pronounced dead a few days later at hospital. The state broadcaster is accused of airing, quote, forced confessions of detainees, according to an EU statement. A baseless claim that has surprised Press TV staff and managers, as no such forced confessions have been produced or broadcast by the English-language news channel during the recent riots. On the contrary, the news channel has made a great effort to counter fake narratives fostered by Western media.
They make claims about Press TV producing and airing forced confessions. I've been working here at Press TV for almost a decade now, and I can tell you that Press TV has not aired any confessions whatsoever, forced or unforced. So that shows you how such decisions by the EU and the like are based on unfounded claims with no basis in reality. You know, I see this as part of their hybrid warfare against Iran. If you look at the big picture, you see them supporting terrorist groups, and these sanctions on Press TV I see as part of the media war and their narrative control. They want to present the war with their distorted version of what's going on in Iran these days, and seemingly they don't feel much comfortable with Press TV challenging their narrative. So they would try everything to silence us or make us less heard, but we're not going to be silenced.
Riots broke out in Iran in mid-September after the death of Mahsa Amini. Rioters brutally attacked security officers and caused massive damage to public property. Iran's intelligence ministry has revealed that the United States and the United Kingdom were directly involved in the unrest, adding that dozens of terrorists affiliated with the Israeli regime and anti-revolution groups have also been detained in the unrest. Experts believe that sanctions imposed on Press TV by the EU and earlier by the government of Canada are aimed at muzzling free speech and alternative views. And once again, the term human rights violations has turned into a tool for Western countries to advance their own agenda, as street riots in Iran don't seem to be achieving the goals they expected. Taking into consideration all the different aspects, Press TV is not discouraged by the unfair treatment and false accusations. Despite all obstacles, Press TV will continue to be the voice of the voiceless, reporting underreported stories and news overlooked by mainstream media. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
When there's mutual trust, a deal is a deal. It's this easy to arrive at an agreement when the two sides of the bargain are from Russia and Iran. These B2B meetings come as part of an economic forum held in Tehran between Iranian businesses and over 100 companies from Russia.
We're a Russian logistic company, and we're here to participate in this business forum to find some partners for business with Iran. We are thinking to transport goods to Iran, from Iran, through Iran.
Our activity is about gas, oil, petrochemical equipment, machinery, instrument. We can export many items to Russian companies. For example, as the machinery, as raw material, and it can help both sides to develop their business relationship as soon as possible.
Tehran and Moscow's interests coincide on many fronts. Both are faced with U.S. sanctions, and both are signatories to the 2015 deal, which has faced troubles following the U.S. withdrawal from the pact in 2018 and the reinstatement of sanctions on Iran. While the bans have adversely affected the Russo-Iranian trade, businessmen here believe there's a strong will from both Tehran and Moscow to overcome those restrictions.
I don't think it will be like a very, very big problem for our countries. Just, we have a border, we have a Caspian Sea, and we can transport cargo. This sanction, it is some problem for the trading, for the money transferring, but it's okay for logistics, no problem.
The American measures have complicated the Russian-Iranian commercial ties when it comes to money transfer and banking transactions. While alternatives such as the use of national currencies have already paid off, legal experts attending this forum say they have a better way out. Cryptocurrency.
Using cryptocurrencies, Iran and Moscow can effectively ditch the U.S. dollar. So if the two sides include this transaction method in their contracts, they can proceed with their businesses seamlessly without any concern over the impacts of U.S. measures.
Visits between Iranian and Russian officials have in recent months increased, following the West tightening its economic measures against both countries. Tehran and Moscow are now eyeing a 20-year strategic partnership treaty that would lay out the roadmap for future expansion of ties at all levels, from politics to economy and security.
This year, Tehran and Russia traded some $4 billion worth of commodities, roughly 90% up compared to last year's trade volume. Now, given the growing relationship between the two sides, the Iran-Russia Chamber of Commerce predicts that this figure will hit $10 billion by 2024. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
In just the past 9 months, the EU and US have together pumped €32 billion worth of lethal weapons into Ukraine. At a meeting here in Brussels on Tuesday, EU defence ministers agreed to increase their military spending by a huge amount between now and the end of 2025.
€70 billion.
Apparently, there is an urgent need to replace weapons being sent to Ukraine.
The supply of arms to Ukraine, it's a continuous flow. It flows every day. And every day there is a member state who provides more. The system has already been provided. I don't think we need new systems. What they need is ammunition to make the systems work.
One expert we interviewed online told us it is a dangerous policy.
The problem with further funding is that it suggests further escalation. An escalation is hazardous because by intent or by miscalculation, it can lead all of the parties into a nuclear conflict.
Many peace activists and rights groups say the military spending is grotesque given the EU's growing social crisis. Those in the European Parliament who oppose NATO and are calling for peace talks between Russia and Ukraine are furious at attempts to silence them.
We talk about democracy, but where is this going to end up? Those you brand as populist and anti-European have a democratic right to disagree with you on the course that Europe is taking.
Defence ministers have agreed to establish camps in up to 20 EU nations that will be used to train Ukrainian soldiers. Some security analysts are suggesting long-standing, controversial ambitions to create an EU army within the EU have effectively been put on hold. And now the strategy is to create an EU army in Ukraine. Jerome Hughes, Brussels. Iran insists that recent riots in the country were orchestrated by outside adversaries such as the United States. But EU foreign ministers meeting in Brussels on Monday took a different view. They have agreed on new sanctions against Iran, claiming the rioters are seeking freedom.
To support them, today the Council adopted another 31 listing under the Iran human rights regime.
The channel you are watching now, Press TV, has also been added to the EU sanctions list. Press TV management has vehemently rejected claims by the EU that the channel broadcast forced confessions from detainees during recent riots in Iran. EU officials have been asked to provide evidence to back up the claims. But it's already clear that will not be forthcoming, simply because it never happened. This latest set of sanctions follows similar measures against Iran taken by the EU in October.
Iran is geographically in a very strong position because they can decide, okay, if the European Union is going to make life harder in terms of sanctions, we can close or threaten to close the Strait of Hormuz. That means that Qatar, which is the principal supplier, I think about 70% of gas is coming from Qatar these days, will be stranded.
One EU minister says the new sanctions should not be allowed to derail talks around the JCPOA Iran nuclear deal.
I hope that this can be kept separated because the JCPOA negotiations, of course, it has a long history already, and I would say it's this close that we could get an agreement on JCPOA.
During a debate on human rights in the European Parliament a few days ago, the EU was accused of displaying double standards.
Europe has invaded and butchered millions, plundered and committed genocide, overthrown and murdered revolutionaries, backed brutal dictators, imposed murderous sanctions.
Amid growing economic turmoil in the EU, many experts claim sanctions against Russia have backfired. In other words, sanctions don't work. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن می کند.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
This is a part of political divine will of the founder of Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini. The U.S. policy close ally is then